This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
There's no graveyard way back. Deep in them woods, the thing you're looking for is in there.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are looking at the 1988 cult horror classic Pumpkinhead in the lead-up to Halloween. We'll go over some news first, tell you a bit about the movie, our thoughts, and then get stuck into the science that this movie brings up, including what a digitigrade is, how estivation works, and how to stun your prey. And then Libby is forcing us to come up with some more vice demons than just the demon of vengeance. As always, the show is going to be broken up into those different segments. We'll have time codes below. Skip ahead. Go to the bits you're looking for, by all means. Before we get into that, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm a freshwater / invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim in Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside co-host Adam Harsik, who is a diseased ecologist at the Bergarian University of the Negev.
I'm happy to say I've never been diseased. I'm very happy to claim that, so you know.
Alongside Adam, at least on my screen, because they are in different
places. And my screen.
For once, yeah. Is this the first time we've had three different continents? I think so.
Yeah. Am I in a different continent, technically?
Well, it depends. Is Eurovision on? No. Then yes, you're in Asia, right?
Yes.
Yeah. If Eurovision was on, of course, you would be in Europe, as I would be if I was in Australia, apparently. Alongside Adam is the Baroness, Her Ladyship Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup. Dave is off on a research trip. Well, it's not a research trip. He said, because, you know, we've talked about his beaver cannon recently. He said he was meeting Shark Tank with his beaver cannon. I don't know if he was referring to the TV show or if he was just shooting beavers into a tank full of sharks. I don't know. Could be either.
Or if he's meeting with a literal tank full of sharks to see what they think about it.
Oh, yeah, they'd probably love it, right? I mean, that's like fast food delivery for them.
Exactly. Oh, it's like going to Lambert's.
It's like DoorDash.
DoorDash? Is this an American?
Uber Eats.
Yeah.
Okay, so news today, and I know that this story has been out there for a little bit, but it is just, it's so worth talking about. The first broke in 2018, and it's the story of a man called Cameron Crowe and a white-naped crane called... Fuck, I've forgotten her name.
His wife.
Mrs. Crow.
His wife. Mrs. Crow, yeah. I'll Google it while I'm reading this off. The white-naped crane is an endangered species. And basically, to avoid the chicks, for want of a better term, imprinting on humans at birth, they raise them away from humans with other white-naped cranes. They keep humans out of the picture. But they didn't always know to do this. So back in the 80s and 90s, there were a bunch of these cranes that were born and humans were the first thing they saw. So a lot of these cranes don't recognize themselves when they see other white-naped cranes. They identify more with humans. And so there was this one crane who was moved to a new zoo and instantly formed a bond of sorts with a new keeper.
Bond of sorts, he says.
A bond of sorts. We'll get into more of it later. But I do want to point out that, like I said, this is an endangered species, and it was highly suspected that this female had killed two males beforehand. Now, since this is a endangered species, it is highly desirable that A, this crane not, who, by the way, is called Walnut.
Walnut.
It is desirable that this crane, yeah, not kill a bunch of males, and B, that she have as many babies as possible. So when she started to form this bond with the keeper, she would initiate a mating dance with him. And he was like, well, I guess, you know, this will make it more comfortable for her, for me to be around her. So he reciprocated the mating dance. And he artificially inseminates her on a semi-regular basis in order for this crane, Walnut, to produce more chicks. And he, it's not just, you know, you might think, oh, well, he's putting all the work on this poor female and, you know, he doesn't have to do anything. But he actually will stand guard over the eggs as well. she doesn't mind as long as he just kind of stands there over them. He doesn't have to sit on them or anything like that. And white-naped cranes generally don't take too many partners in their life. So he's essentially just married to this bird.
Well, they live for like 60 years too, right?
Yeah, and she's currently, I think, in her 30s. Yeah, she's in her 30s. I think he's in his late 30s as well.
Late 30s, early 40s, yeah. So he's with this bird for life.
If you've ever seen a guy on Facebook back when, you know, relationship statuses were all the rage, and he had 5 kids with another woman, but it was, it's complicated.
It's this guy.
That's this to a T. Yeah.
I hope he has more than 5 kids with this bird.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe Facebook had a maximum of 5 kids that you could register. I don't know. I never tried it. But yeah, I think it's amazing that, you know, the lengths this man is willing to go to take care of his bird wife and ensure the survival of a species. I mean, he's doing an amazing thing and we should all respect him.
We should all take care of our bird wife. Yeah.
But yeah, we should all support Cameron Crowe and Walnut.
Mrs. Crowe.
Is it Cameron Crowe? I should make sure that, that I've got his name right.
It's definitely Crow.
Chris Crow. Chris Crow. Not Cameron Crow.
Yeah. Cameron, if you're friends. Maybe.
Oh, and in other news, movie-related monster news, I saw Dune on the weekend.
Did you?
Mm-hmm. For some reason, it was out in Europe a month before being out in America.
Yeah, I think it's out here as well.
Without any spoilers, what would you rate it?
Oh, good. I don't want to give any spoilers because I don't want to shape people's opinion mm-hmm. on it, but what I will say is that I did not expect the bagpipes.
So we take this movie back to the great, great year of 1988. It's one of my favorite years.
Two years too soon.
Is that when you were born?
It is. So this movie is about a strangely jacked hillbilly who owns a Backhills grocery store with his child and dog. A couple of...
I don't think they're all owners. I think it's his name on the contract.
It says and son.
The dog? I agree.
Oh, and son. But not the dog?
He's a silent partner.
Okay.
Sorry. Shut up. So, a couple of quintessential 80s teens visit the area and decide that they can't wait any longer to dirt bike, so they decide to do it next to the road. Father of the year decides chicken feed is more important and leaves his 6-year-old child unattended with complete strangers whom he has already witnessed bullying his child. Classic dirt bike child slaughter, I would say manslaughter, but it's child, so child slaughter occurs, but it's kind of okay because the dog lives. Recalling an old hills folk tale and dark memory from his past, our intrepid father decides that instead of taking his boy to proper medical care, he'll await his death and then summon a vengeance demon to kill pretty much everyone. Classic moral flip-floppery takes place, and he decides to help the people he so desperately wants dead. After fighting the inevitable, he realizes that he himself is a voodoo doll for the demon and does both of them in with the world's worst headshot.
Yeah.
What did we like about this?
I think I really enjoyed the setting, even though it couldn't seem to make up its mind for what it wanted to be, because it's supposed to be this like backwoods hillbilly type.
Hills have eyes.
People, which you would see. Yeah, hills have eyes, which is something you would see in like the deep south, not the desert, which is where the store seems to be set. It's like they have their little dirt shop in New Mexico, and then they go back to like deep fucking South Carolina to go back to their house. But it's fun, and I really enjoy a good monster movie, and I've never seen this one before, and it definitely did not disappoint me.
I loved the stereotypical witch named Haggis. What a witchy name. Classic witch name, Haggis.
I liked how quick it was. Like, not in a bad way, like, I'm not saying I liked how short it was. It felt like a full story, and it was only, you know, 80 minutes or so. I like the spooky swamp aesthetic, as contradictory as it is to the to the desert that it starts in. And it's a fun creature design. And yeah, I agree with Libby. Every time that old witch says, Ed Hardy!
Ed Hardy! Like,
yeah. Harley, was it? Yeah, Harley.
Yeah, Ed Hardy. There was not nearly enough bedazzling on his jeans.
Yeah. And Lance Henriksen was good as well.
He always is.
What about what didn't we like?
Child actors, I feel like, in movies, usually have one bar, and that's, were they annoying? No? Okay, then they were good. And this kid was annoying as fuck. I was happy to see him get plastered by a fucking dirt bike, because he was being dumb. He was annoying. It was annoying. I was not a fan of it. Also, the one thing that really stood out to me was, you're trying to show these, like, fucking dirt people who live in the middle of nowhere, and homeboy has got, like, the most beautiful set of teeth you've ever seen on a human being in your life. This fucking winning smile, bright, white teeth. Like, no, you are not a dirt person, or those aren't your real teeth. Like, make up your mind.
Could be fake.
They could be spending all their money on Colgate.
It's a good investment.
Yeah.
Libby? I actually thought the kid actor did fine. Lance Henriksen was escort, of course, awesome. The ones that really annoyed me were the teenagers. I felt like I was watching a really bad high school play whenever they acted, and it was just very grating.
Yeah.
I just love that all of them are complete friends with this sociopath.
Who goes off the rails real fucking fast.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And even when he expresses remorse, I'm like, you're too far gone, man.
Yeah. No.
You only feel bad because of what happened, not because it was a bad thing.
I think I agree with what Adam and Libby said. I didn't mind the child actor. I mean, he's not great, but it's the 80s and he's in it for like 5 minutes before he gets off. But it's a weird thing because I'm a massive wuss when it comes to horror films. So me saying this, I feel means something. This isn't scary. Like, this is a horror film, but it's not. I don't find this scary at all.
No.
It's barely a thriller, I would say.
Yeah, it's. But I mean, look, I don't think there's a lot to hate in this just because it's all told so concisely.
Yeah.
And even if you don't like it, it's over in a flash.
So. I think for me, this movie could have really benefited from the Evil Dead style humor. Like, it needed to not take itself so seriously. And not that it does, but it just tries to be like a straight kind of horror film. And I felt like with the cheesy acting and the cheesy plot, it just needed to embrace that. And kind of go over the top. I also wish I would have seen more, like, gore. I felt that that was missing.
Yeah.
This woman gets dropped from a 30-foot, 10-meter tree and just nothing happens. She's just, like, a little hurt. There'd be some bone sticking out, maybe a lot of blood splattered around. She got dropped on a fucking rock.
So for trivia this week, Pumpkinhead itself was based on a poem by Ed Justin. The director, Stan Winston, this was his debut film. Do you guys know who Stan Winston is?
I do.
He did the special effects for a bunch of other more recognizable
films. Oh yeah,
films,
Aliens, right? Terminator, lots of James Cameron stuff, pretty prominent. Special effects guy, won a bunch of Oscars. So this was his directorial debut. And some interesting things about him is that we found this interesting for the pod, he sort of rose to prominence in Hollywood for his work on The Thing, the Kurt Russell version. He also, bit of trivia, directed and co-produced the longest music video of all time, which was Ghosts, with Michael Jackson and Stephen King.
He did Ghost?
Uh-huh. I didn't know that. 39-minute long music video.
Oh, I've seen it.
39 minutes?
Yeah.
It's basically a short film with music in it.
Yeah. So, also, I found it interesting, I looked into Lance Henriksen a little bit, what I did not know about him is that he didn't start acting till after he was 30, and he was also illiterate until then, and he taught himself to read for work, for plays.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's fucking impressive. Good on you, Lance.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, so his first role, he had to put the entire script to tape with the help of his friend, and he learned everyone's part just by audio, like, listening to it.
Wow.
I thought it'd be fun if I read the poem from Ed Justin that inspired the movie. Yes. Should I do it in my best Haggis voice? Ed yes. Harley.
Ed Harley.
Ed Harley. Keep away from Pumpkinhead unless you're tired of living. His enemies are mostly dead. He's mean and unforgiving. Laugh at him and you're undone, but in some dreadful fashion. Vengeance he considers fun and plans it with a passion. Time will not erase or blot a plot that he has brewing. It's when you think that he's forgot he'll conjure your undoing. Bolted doors and windows barred, guard dogs prowling in the yard, won't protect you in your bed. Nothing will from Pumpkinhead. Ed Harley.
Just before we start looking at the science, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Harsic Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can also chat or game with us on Discord. Just type in cinematicaanimalia and you will find us. If you'd like to read Libby's work, visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. And if you want to hear about the less movie-related science that Adam and I write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com for articles from us and a huge team of international writers.
Yes.
So, today, I just wanted to start with the first thing that I noticed about this creature, which was that it is what we refer to as a digitigrade. Yeah, so humans are plantigrade creatures, right? Because we walk, well, with what we know as our feet planted on the ground. Digitigrade creatures, which things you might know, like dogs, cats, and most birds, walk with the only part of their foot flat on the ground. The part of their foot that they have flat on the ground is what we would think of as our toes. And the rest of their foot forms kind of their heel. That's as opposed to, for instance, ungulate. Fuck, what are they
called?
Ungulates, yeah, but there's a word for the ungulograde. So ungulograde are the kind of the third option. And most of these are, as you can probably figure out from the name, ungulates. Things like horse, deer, sheep,
moose,
rhinos, hippos, camels. But this thing is, as you might have noticed during the film, a digitigrade. So yeah, it's got that massive kind of heel at the back, which is what corresponds to us as the flat of the foot. Now, there aren't many digitigrade bipeds, so things that walk on two legs, around anymore apart from birds. But there were ages ago. So most dinosaurs, like the classic two-legged dinosaurs that we think of, like T-Rex, Velociraptors, and dinosaurs of their ilk, were digitigrade bipeds. And as you can probably tell from the examples I've given, they moved faster over a reasonable distance. They're really good. A lot of them are really good cursorial hunters. Cursorial being, you know, something that can chase down prey.
Like a wolf.
And so that's in direct contrast with the way that Pumpkinhead acts during the movie, I feel. Because he's just really, for something that's built the way he is, that could easily, like, you know, just outrun pretty much any other thing on two legs.
Seems to be built for sprinting.
Yeah, and he's just loping around like fucking Lurch from the Addams Family. Like
he does a lot of standing and looking.
Yeah.
I don't even think I saw him walk once. He just stands, like Olivia said.
Yeah, he's just like all of a sudden they turn around and he's there and he's not like moving towards them. He's just snarling, menacing.
His little like,
which is kind of like the Michael Myers conundrum with the Halloween movies. Because like he's just a dude that walks. He doesn't run. He doesn't chase you down. Yeah. He's just coming at you slowly, which in a way is a lot more terrifying.
Yeah, absolutely. And with Michael Myers and Jason Voorhees, I understand why, because it's just a guy with a knife or a machete Or, you know, something, whatever they're wielding. But with this, it's obviously not human. Like, it's meant to superficially resemble a human, I guess, in some sense. But it's built for speed. Like, it even has the tail out the back. And this is the other thing about this design, is that I think Dave actually talked about this earlier this season. The experiment where they put a tail on a chicken. Like, they got a bunch of, I think it was a plunger, right? And they attached it to a chicken's butt,
mm-hmm.
right? So they essentially put a tail on the chicken. And the chicken went from a very upright posture to very much leaning forward mm-hmm. over to balance out. And that's what most species did. If they had large upper bodies, they would perhaps have a tail out the back to help them balance out. And he has a tail. There's a tail out the back, so he should be crouched over, which you do see in some of the promotional material, a more sort of hunched over look. But in this film, he's standing up the entire time, like just standing up straight.
But it almost seems to be more like a prehensile, like rat tail, less of a big, thick, digitigrade tail.
I was going to ask too, can he be using it sort of like a kangaroo where he's like leaning on it a little bit more? Because they're pretty upright when they stand.
Yeah, potentially, but I think... Yeah, and it is, like Adam said, I mean, there's enough to have some weight out there, but there would need to be a lot of muscle, and I think it would need to be a bit broader to support him.
It looks very thin.
Yeah, and when kangaroos move, again, when they're on the move, they are very much, they have that kind of, the plane of their body is parallel to the ground. And there's no, I mean, again, we never see him run. So maybe, you know, he's just sprinted up, decided he needs to take a quick break, stand upright before, you know, goes in for the final kill. Maybe he thinks he's camouflaged.
If this creature thinks it's camouflaged, that is a laugh and a half, and I love it.
Yeah.
This creature's hilarious. I'm not going to lie. Pumpkinhead has a fantastic sense of humor.
I think so.
When he takes that girl's face and, like, peekaboos it in the window, oh my god. Phenomenal. What a jokester.
And he doesn't even, like, smash her through the glass. He just not keeps at first. Pushing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's like, now that I think about that, it kind of makes me think of the sequel to the recent versions of It with Bill Skarsgård as Pennywise, of him just with a kid trapped in the mirror house and him, like, banging on it, like, ha ha ha, I'm gonna get you. I'm gonna get you.
And when they walk outside of the, when they walk outside of the cabin and he's, like, holding the girl up from the tree and he's like, I'm going to drop her. Am I going to drop her? Are you going to make it in time? Yeah.
And he just does it very unconcerned about everything.
Yeah. But, okay, that's the other thing that goes counter to the creature design is the fact that he's always up in fucking trees.
Yeah, it's strange.
Yeah. I mean, that lifestyle would make sense. You know, snatching as an ambush predator. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, jaguars are a good example. Like, things that just fucking jump and crush their prey underfoot.
Get ya.
And dragging your prey up into a tree is a really good strategy when you have other carnivores around that are perhaps bigger and stronger than you. One of the reasons that leopards have evolved this tactic is because leopards don't have to worry about the myriad other predators that they have to share the savannah with, like lions, like hyenas.
Tigers and bears, oh my.
Yeah, they can just drag their prey up into the tree and feast on it there, and they don't have to worry about sharing. So it would be a good tactic. But like I said, the shoulders are really well built for it. As we've said a bunch of times before, anytime you have something with vaguely human shoulders, those things are going to have evolved from a climbing history, right?
Some kind of arboreal species.
Yeah, because, they're built for... What is it, Dave, and you brought this term up recently? Brachiation?
It is, brachiation.
Yeah, this is a little weirder because he's got those enormous protrusions coming out of his shoulders, which I have no explanation for that.
I think my explanation for that is coming from Stan Winston, having worked on Aliens and worked with the Xenomorph, which this body looks very... very similar to a xenomorph.
Yeah. And it's weird that we have this obsession with incredibly emaciated looking beings where every kind of feature is showing. I mean, in reality, if it's feeding on a regular basis, which of course we know it's not, and we'll get to that kind of, you know, waking up and food deprived later on, it shouldn't, I mean, we don't see many other species that look like that.
No, I mean, it's not like you really only see obese animals in captivity. Things don't get fat in the wild because they can't. It's just too hard being a wild animal.
Unless it's Fat Bear Week.
Unless it's Fat Bear Week. Different situation.
Yeah.
But usually an animal, if it looks like that, it's on its way to death. Not hunting down, you know, a gaggle of teenagers. Teenagers in quotations, because all these actors are clearly in their 30s.
Yeah. Well, and it could be old, too, because I know animals, they start to lose that process of, you know, fat retention. So when they're aged, they're very skeletal.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, I think potentially an arboreal lifestyle of, you know, ambushing things from the trees or dragging prey up into the trees would make sense. But it just directly clashes with what we were talking about before, the fact that we've got a species that looks like it's built for running, built for chasing down prey, as opposed to ambushing them.
Also, with this ambushing and bringing them to a tree, completely overriding them by immediately dropping them from the tree to splatter on the ground.
Yeah. So we should talk about this then, because there are species that will stun their prey. Or drop them to open them up. I love talking about cane toads. And there are some species in Australia that have developed defences against cane toads. One of them being our native corvids. Well, they're not actually corvids. They look a lot like corvids. They're passerines, but things Americans and Europeans
songbirds
recognize. Magpies, crows, currawongs. Species of passerine in Australia, songbirds that look a lot like crows, they have adapted really quickly to cane toads, which are normally poisonous, by flying up to a certain height, dropping them from that height, and it stuns them so they can't release the poison, but also it doesn't splatter everything so they can go down and, you know, have a nice little compact feast. we've all seen the amazing videos of orcas, killer whales, just slapping the fuck out of seals.
Yeah.
Just stun the crap out of them and just launching them into the air.
Those are some scary animals.
Dolphins do that with fish as well? They'll launch them with their tails to stun them.
I didn't know that, but I absolutely think...
Yeah, I think they do.
I think orcas do it underwater, so... I mean... I don't know if you know this, Libby, but orcas are actually a type of dolphin, so yes.
Learn something new.
Cetacean.
cetacean, yeah. They have this this argument comes up all the time. I see it, like, people being like, oh, actually, orcas are dolphins, not whales. I'm like, yeah, what the fuck is a dolphin? It's a type of whale. Shut up.
Go fuck yourself.
Back to your rock. But Adam, you had a theory as to why it might be, you know, dropping things or tenderizing the meat.
Yeah, so I think that... Well, our first glimpse of Pumpkinhead waking up from his slumber, he has a weird baby grandpa mouth with, like, two teeth on the top and bottom, so maybe four teeth total in this weird, like, toothless mouth. But he's just big, grippy hands with these massive claws, but the teeth don't really seem to be that great, especially towards the end of the movie when it looks more and more like Lance Henriksen. So I'm thinking that Pumpkinhead employs a strategy similar to a shrike, where a shrike is a small bird that does not have a good grip strength in its feet to hold prey while it eats them. So what they like to do is grab their little bit of prey and impale it on either a stick, cactus thorn, barbed wire is a very popular spot for shrikes now. Anywhere where there's a sharp point, they will stick their prey on there to either die or to keep them alive for a little bit so they can then go back and eat them at their leisure without having to hold on to them with their very weak feet. So I think that Pumpkinhead likes to take his prey up into a tree and drop it, so that way their body is a bit more tenderized, potentially even busted open. He doesn't have to worry about trying to eat them with his non-existent fangs.
Yeah, okay. So you think he's probably chasing down prey by slashing at them or clawing at them, and then... once they're, you know, weak enough, dragging them up into trees.
The big finger to the claws would also be good, useful for climbing. And for grabbing a hold of a prey onto prey and keeping a good hold of it, much like a cat would.
Yeah, though I was about to say, we actually never see Pumpkinhead, except for maybe the first kill, use his body to kill those people. He uses gravity, he uses a gun. He used it, which was fantastic, by the way. You know, he's using all the, he uses the kitchen window, pushes her through. So
after
glass.
Carving a cross into her forehead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, see, I think that the top half of Pumpkinhead on its own makes a lot of sense, and the bottom half on its own makes a lot of sense. But when you put them together, like, you just have two entirely different predators.
Yeah.
They go together so well, just like chocolate and peanut butter.
I think you did solve the mystery of why it's so strangely sinewy is because it is a mirror of Lance Henriksen.
That gristly, wiry motherfucker.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So, another thing that doesn't... that's a bit interesting for this creature is the habitat. So, most of this movie takes place in this backwoods, kind of swampy type setting, very reminiscent of a Pet Sematary kind of vibe, where you have an antagonist go deep, deep into the woods, go to this kind of unholy, or holy, depending on how you look at it, place, to do some pretty weird shit. But Pumpkinhead seems to be this arboreal ambush predator, which would not really evolve in a swamp-like environment, I don't think. They're just, the trees are not prevalent enough in a swamp to support this kind of creature. You would think it'd be more aquatic. And for this kind of organism, especially like that, you would expect it to find where you would a leopard. You know, somewhere with a lot of really big, strong trees and prey that would be more amenable to that. Unless he's trying to haul up a freaking gator to the trees, which maybe he could.
Yeah.
But it's strange.
And the bottom half doesn't really fit with it either, because, I mean, you don't... Yeah, like, cursorial species live in areas where there's lots of open spaces.
To be able to run.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To run down their prey, that's what they've evolved to do, which is a theory for why we were so successful relative to other hominid species, especially after the Ice Age.
But, yeah, well, I mean, the ecosystem we see at the very start, the kind of the grasslands, that might work better for the bottom half, but it sure as hell doesn't work for the top half.
Yeah, I mean, there's enough creatures there in that weird desert, pseudo-desert that they're living in that could work.
Yeah.
But yeah, he would need open spaces for that kind of body plan.
Dave has taken some extra notes because, you know, he's dealing with shark tanks and beaver cannons, or shark cannons and beaver tanks, whatever you will have this week. But he wanted us to talk a bit about estivation. Now, we've talked about hibernation a lot before. Estivation is kind of the same thing, but when there's a lack of moisture and it gets too hot as opposed to when it gets too cold. So the difference between estivation and hibernation, apart from the obvious that I've just stated, is that when it comes to estivation, you need to be keeping in as much moisture as possible.
Yes.
So a lot of species that do it are species that can lose moisture really easily through their skin. So some of the typical ones are burrowing frogs, land snails, and lungfish.
I was going to say, I had the pleasure of seeing some of those land snails this last weekend at Wadi Mamshit out here in the Negev.
Really?
The desert. Yeah, there's just all the like shrubs here are covered in these snails that are just hanging out until winter when it's a bit more wet and they can kind of come out of their estivation.
So the land snails are one amazing example. Another one is the lungfish. Now, the lungfish are a member of the Sarcopterygii. I hope I'm pronouncing that properly. I think that's what it is.
The English now, translation the of the Greek word, yeah. You did a really good job.
Yeah.
If you say it fast enough, no one will know.
So the Sarcopterygii are us as well. We belong to the clade Sarcopterygii, which is why people might remember when we had Danny and Aoife on from the Aficionados podcast. They were talking about James McAvoy technically being a fish, because the Sarcopterygii are the lobe fin fishes, which we belong to, as opposed to the ray fin fishes, the Actinopterygii, which is the things you think of when you typically think of other fish. They're the ray fin fishes. But the only actual fish, or things that we think of as fish, left over from the Sarcopterygii are the lungfish. So they're this incredibly, not primitive, but they're a very, very old body plan that just hasn't changed that much over the last... I want to say 200 million years?
Something like
probably
that.
Probably longer.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, no, hang on. 200 million years, there were still dinosaurs around, so more like 300 million years, probably.
It's one of those really fun discussions you get into with any kind of evolutionary biologist or evolutionary ecologist when you call a species primitive or basal, because some people really take offense to that.
Yeah, because it's not... I mean... Primitive is a stupid word, but it's just a way of saying that it's a body plan that was around a long, long time ago and just hasn't changed.
It's a way of saying it's old.
It's like
as
when
shit.
We talk about crocodiles. Yes. Yeah. We talk about crocodiles being really old. I mean, they've changed a lot, crocodiles. It's just that their basic body plan's still very similar to what it was back then, which is why we think of them. You hear them sometimes called a living fossil, or the coelacanth, or the tuatara being called living fossils. They're not. They've just got the same body plan as they did, you know, 50, 100 million years ago. That's all.
Yeah, so all the changes happened. They're not really, like, too many new species from it. And the length of their branches on the tree of life are very, very long. And the thing to keep in mind with those branches is it's a thing called anagenesis, where the organisms that are, or the populations that are evolving within that branch are changing over time. So like the sharks we have today are not the same ones that they had back when the dinosaurs were around, but they are changing within that branch, within that lineage. So they're still the same, quote, species over time, but they're not changing enough to be a different species.
So why are lungfish so cool?
So lungfish, as the name implies, can still breathe air. And there are a few different species of both lobe-fin and ray-fin fish can do this. So gar, for instance, can breathe air as well. But yeah, so what lungfish will do, and what, like I said, the other species that I mentioned as well, burrowing frogs and land snails will do, is they'll burrow into the mud or the dirt, and they will form a cocoon of mucus, which then hardens around them, that I believe is transparent enough to let air in, but doesn't let moisture out. So way they don't lose any moisture, but they can still take in a little bit of oxygen. I say a little bit because these do go through massive anoxic or lacking oxygen periods that can have some severely negative effects on them. But for the most part, they are still breathing in some capacity. Lungfish will start to gulp in air.
So you're saying they're making their own still suit. A little teaser for Dune here in a couple of weeks.
That was really cool, actually. I got a stupid joke about that later, but I won't tell it now. But the really cool thing is that I find about estivation is that whereas hibernation is triggered generally at a certain time of the year by different types of weather, estivation can happen whenever there's not enough moisture around. So it doesn't have to be a seasonal thing. It can just be whenever, which makes sense because, I mean, in dry areas, you never know when you're just not going to get rain for a very long period of time, 2 or 3 years. And so lungfish can actually estivate for up to 4 years. So they can just be, down in the ground in the, hardened cocoon for 4 years at a time. And they'll just come out of that state as soon as there's enough moisture around. So once the rain hits.
And we talk about this because Pumpkinhead seems to come out of whatever estivation state they were in because of human blood. Both Lance Henriksen and dead child blood.
Yeah. Be better off with just like a pint of water.
Just throw a cup of water on them.
So with lungfish, my question is, lungfish go through estivation by using mud. So how do other animals do it? Like, how do the snails do it? How do the other creatures that you were mentioning go through that process? Is it the same or?
Yeah, it's similar. So they, both the lung snails and the land snails and the burrowing frogs form a skin of kind of mucus that just hardens around their bodies and traps all the moisture. Gotcha.
Snails just do it at like the little door to their shell. They retreat inside and, like, gate it off, basically.
Yeah. So the frogs can be really creepy because, I mean, some frogs burrow. Some other frogs will just find crevices in rocks or that sort of thing and do it there. And they look like they've got a really hard layer of... the skin's gone really hard and they've turned to stone. But it's just one layer around the side. And if you crack it, there's normal skin underneath. And that'll generally just crack and peel off when the moisture comes back.
Cool.
I've never been lucky enough to see one. We have a lot of these burrowing frogs in Australia, but I've never... I haven't spent too much time out in the desert.
Not allowed to see in the desert, turns out.
Very brown, right?
A lot of hum.
I know they explained Pumpkinhead as living, or his corpse is living in a pumpkin patch. But that does not make sense to me why he is called Pumpkinhead. Was 1 year, that he came out, did he just like accidentally get a pumpkin stuck on his head? And that's just kind of the name that stuck.
I assume they're talking about that massive kind of, the bulbous growth behind. I mean, stonefish don't necessarily look like a stone. I guess if like some, maybe there was just a generation of the, you know, the hillbillies that just had really poor vision.
Yeah, there is.
Most of them probably. Yeah, they're all probably anemic too.
If you go with either of the two halves, right? You go with just a, like, a climbing ambush predator or a really fast runner. Either of those is still terrifying, right?
Yeah, for sure.
I don't understand the... I mean, obviously, we know, and we do come off as a bit wanky sometimes on this podcast. We know that people make decisions not based on biology, just what looks aesthetically cool. We should reassure people. We do
and
know this.
Enjoy that.
We sound like we forget yeah. all the time. Yes, we do. But I feel that, yeah, either half would have worked by itself. You didn't have to combine the two in a way that, you know, makes the entire appearance make kind of
I think for plot purposes, it kind of has to be more the arboreal, though, because if you just get humans yeah. in an open plane with a thing that can outrun you, there's not really anything that you can do to survive other than maybe just get really, really lucky.
Yeah. And Jurassic Park's done it well enough with the Velociraptors.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that scene's yeah. been done, and will never be done better in any other movie. Probably.
Yeah, so you gotta have some duck and cover, some things to objects and obstacles to work around.
Like your slower
top
friend.
Half, then.
Yeah, top half.
Yeah.
Don't go into the long grass.
So I thought it would be fun this week, instead of sort of talking about, I think past couple weeks have been a little bit more educational, cerebral, if you will. I thought it would be fun to dive back into the creative side. So when I was watching this movie and my favorite Witch of the Woods, Haggis, was talking about Pumpkinhead, saying that he was a vengeance demon, she mentioned it was kind of almost a throwaway line that he was a demon of a vice demon and that there are other demons of human vices. So immediately I latched onto that idea and thought, well, what do those look like? Cause that's awesome.
What that
so do? Yeah, exactly. So since I cannot unfortunately ask Haggis what those vice demons are and where they're located and what they do and look okay. like, I thought I would ask my co-host to create their own vice demons. And I think instinct would be to go to Seven Deadly Sins, but I gave them the parameters that it can be any vice. It does not have to be the classic human vices. Vengeance is not a Seven Deadly Sin, so it's open to a creative interpretation.
Adam, you want to go first, or should I? Yeah, okay. I started off with one of the seven deadly sins or vices. I went with sloth, or as we were saying before, sleuth is your David Attenborough. Yeah. I thought that the vice demon for sloth could be just a giant megatherium, one of the sloth ancestors, that just kind of shambles around after you. And if you stay in one place for any longer than absolutely necessary... it just disembowels you with one of those massive fucking Ooh. Claws that it has on one hand. Or, some people might know, but sloths have intensely hard grips. Like, those things that they have can grip onto fucking anything. So maybe it just, like, grabs you by the neck and just squeezes until your head pops clean off, like a champagne cork.
Sorry, I love the idea, too, because it's shambling, that it's just... And it's not, like, picking up its feet. It's just collecting clutter and, like, dust and, like, things that it's just in its path. Yeah. Just stuck to its fur behind it.
Yeah. Just matted in this massive mm-hmm. tangle of, yeah, hillbilly. Well, it doesn't have to be in, you know, hillbilly territory, although I feel it would be fine mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or, instead of strangling you with those massive, massively strong hands... Maybe it just grabs onto you, and now you can't go anywhere because you were too lazy, so you get to starve to death because yeah. you were lazy.
Just a very long hug. Just...
Who would summon this demon, Sam? Mothers that want their sons to get off their ass?
That's exactly what
Stop playing say. Fortnite.
Yeah. A frustrated mother who just wants her son to clear out the fucking weed den with all his loser friends.
My vice is frustrated rage. So, we've all been there. You're driving on the road, trying to obey the traffic laws like you do, and, you know, enjoy the road as you're supposed to. But all these fucking chuckleheads on the road drive like absolute idiots and drive you up the goddamn wall. So, you get to summon the demon of frustrated rage. And this demon, it just chases after the people that have annoyed you. And slighted you in this horrible, horrible way. And it doesn't really do anything. It comes, the instant they forget about it, it comes back. You can't really get a good view of it, and it's really fucking frustrating because you're never quite sure what it is or what it's going to do to you. Mm-hmm. It's just there. and it's always around. It's lurking. And it doesn't grab you. It doesn't fuck with you, really. It's just, its mental mere presence fuckery. Starts to drive you insane. And then you forget about
it. What does it look like?
You never know. You get a glimpse here and there, maybe like
what are the glimpses? Spiky limb. Yeah.
Maybe yeah. I'm thinking a very angular, spiky form, but that's about all you're going to get from this very amorphous, hard to really pin down. Because that's the frustrating thing. You can't tell anybody what's happening to you because you can't fucking describe it.
I love it's that just, I gave you this homework and you just created your wet dream fantasy of fulfilling your yeah. all your road rage issues.
I'm going to stop you right there. When you ask, and go ahead and answer this question before you haven't asked. Who would summon this demon? I would summon this demon because I fucking hate everyone on the goddamn road.
Adam's a very peaceful damn. Driver. Very peaceful.
I am. I just get mad at dumb
sounds
people.
Like it.
Yeah, so I also kind of went with a mental fuckery route, although it could be deadly. So I decided to do an interesting vice. Some people would not call it a vice, but I think anything in too much excess is a vice. So I created the demon of perfectionism. This demon is either summoned by the person itself, like wanting to do a task or something. You know, they want to get the job done right, or maybe they're feeling a little lazy, so they need to be motivated, so they want to get this task done in the perfect way. But it kind of comes back to bite them in the ass, because this demon essentially latches onto your life, and if you do anything less than perfect, either one or two options, it will sit there and make you do it till you do it right. So it just like slowly mentally drives you insane, or it kills you when you mess up. So it's like that imminent threat of fucking up something and not doing it the right way. So I think that was my question vice that I chose. Yes.
Is this perfection in the demon's opinion or your own opinion? Because I think it would be even worse if, because it wasn't good enough for you, the demon kills you.
Yeah. I think it could be both. I think it could be like Pumpkinhead, where it is sort of a manifestation of your own vice, like of that vengeance of your form of perfectionism. So, and then I think I wanted to go the opposite route. So to me, one of my favorite stories is Dorian Gray. So I think I want this thing to look a hot mess. Like it takes all the imperfections and it's just like completely, you know, kind of humanoid, very like slim, so it is creepy, but it's just like you know, torn off face or gross things growing out of it, smell is horrendous, that kind of thing. So it's very like unnerving.
So Mick Jagger plays this in the movie.
Yeah. Unnerving for it to be in your presence while you're trying to do a task perfectly.
I had a couple that were also left on the cutting room floor, which was the vice, the demon of dickheadedness that just pops up and sack taps
you. That was my favorite one.
You're a guy, just, yeah, punches you in the nuts.
Straight dick punch.
Yeah.
Or badge punch. A little cooter kick.
And then the other one was the demon of viral marketing, which is just somebody who constantly downloads U2 albums onto your phone.
I think the demon of viral marketing could also be that annoying person in your life who does not stop talking about the thing that they're doing and want you to like be a part of it.
Well, that's what I was just about to say. That inspires
the multi-level marketing scheme, wants to try to sell you knives, has makeup.
The pyramid scheme demon.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Or like 10 years ago was constantly inviting you to join like Battle Wars or Mafia games on Facebook. Remember all those Facebook games?
God,
yeah, that person, yeah, Candy Crush.
Ooh, that would be good. It's like
played it once in my life.
Kind of like it follows that movie. So if you don't like pass it on, so it's like the MLM demon, where if you don't enlist like 10 people, then you yeah. and they have to enlist 10 people.
Chainmails. It's going back even further,
and they're real.
Now Dave didn't give me a monster. No. So what do you think his would be?
Dave, what does Dave really hate?
Incompetent bits.
Yeah. Anybody else doing something for him? So,
yeah,
maybe a demon of micromanagement. So it's just somebody who comes around and volunteers. No, no, it's somebody who does all your work for you without you asking, and then you have to go back
redo it all over
yeah. again.
Does it kind of half-assed?
Yeah.
Perfect.
Half-assed, poor quality, does the stuff you weren't even planning on doing. It leaves the stuff that needs to be done alone, but fucks up everything else. What would that look like? Imagine like a lot of arms and legs. Like a really spidery looking motherfucker.
Widget the World Watcher.
Widget? Yeah. Isn't it a Watu?
No, Widget the World... Oh, man. Did you guys not watch this TV show?
I haven't watched it yet.
No, okay. Widget the World... Oh, it's from... No, it's from like 20 years ago. Like This was when I was like 7 or 8 years old. Yeah, it's like this just...
Being... That was not 20 years ago, you liar.
Just halfway between like a spider... Yeah, 25 years ago. Fucking hell. I'm almost mid-30s. Sorry, Libby. Halfway between a spider and an octopus. It can poorly sand down a bench, but it can also poorly paint a wall. You know, it can do everything.
Kind of okay.
At 70%.
Yeah. I'm Mr. Meeseeks! Look at me!
So, do we feel bad for Pumpkinhead?
I mean, I feel like that question is more like, do we feel bad for Lance Henriksen's character? And kind of? But I feel like Pumpkinhead is less of... Well, I guess I feel bad for Pumpkinhead in the sense that it was the previous dude who decided to summon the previous dude who was also summoning the previous dude, and they were all Pumpkinheads, so... Mm-hmm. Sorry in the sense that they've literally sold their soul for this, quote, power to use Pumpkinhead, which then results in them becoming Pumpkinhead. So yeah, it's pretty shitty.
I don't feel bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I do feel bad for Lance Henriksen's character because, you know, his son just died. He's not in the right state of mind. He makes a poor decision and then he regrets it.
He makes several poor decisions, one of which leaving his 6-year-old child unattended.
That is a good point. He had space in the truck. Why didn't he just bring
the kids?
They're
country folk. That's what you do. You leave kids
just
around a store.
Put the closed sign on the door. Back in 5 minutes. Take your kid with you. Was not that hard.
Yeah, as Adam likes to point out, keep your fucking dog on a leash. Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Like, god damn.
The amount of fucking wild dogs I've seen here in Israel is really heartbreaking. I hate it.
Would we recommend this movie?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
this movie
sure.
was super fun.
Yeah.
Very cheesy, yeah. Very 80s. It's a short good ride.
Yeah.
And as I tried to say at the start, if you're worried that it's a horror film and you're a big wuss like me,
it's not
scary at all. I really
not in the least.
Yeah. It's comical.
Yeah. So now we've wrapped up Pumpkinhead to continue on with our Halloween extravaganza. We'll be rolling into 30 Days of Night, one of my favorite vampire movies that I haven't actually seen in like 15 years since I first watched it around the time it came out. So
yeah.
I'm excited to get this more animalistic look at vampires. And maybe we can finally go back to Anne Rice vampires. They're all sexy and weird. So yes, to say at the end of it, every episode, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye-bye.
It's gotta run its course.